Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the new episode of the Calcio Land Podcast. And today we have a long, varied episode for you. We're going to wrap up the Scudetto race at the top, briefly preview the Coppa Italia final between Juve and Milan. We're going to name the winners and losers from the Serie A weekend and get to some of your great Twitter questions. We are going to end the podcast on a slightly different note. You guys know that both Alex and I are huge NBA fans, so we're going to talk a little bit about hoops with our good friend Ben Golliver. But also for all you guys that are upcoming journalists, podcast hosts, I think you'll really enjoy this interview because Ben is someone that I really look up to. So not only is there talk about NBA, but there's also a lot of talk on journalism. But before we get to all that, I am joined by our dear friend, co-host, producer, Alex Goldberg. So look, mathematically, the Scudetto race isn't over, but Juve pretty much has the title in the bag. And this weekend, I was thinking a lot about this question, Alex, and I wanted to get your thoughts on it. Between Sarri and Allegri, of the two managers, which one do you think has gotten the most out of his squad this season?
You know, that's a really good question, David. And when I saw this in the outline, my reflex was to say sorry. A, because they've had a really good season, and we've talked ad nauseum about the fact that they're not as deep as Juventus. But actually, saying that, and remembering what we've said recently about Napoli are deeper than people think, that actually makes me officially say Allegri got more out of his squad than Sarri. Because, as I just said, and as you've said many times, David, and even some guests, Napoli have players that Sarri just flat out didn't want to use. He has a deep midfield, whether you think, oh, well, no, he's got Alan and Hamsik and Jorginho. No. He's also got Diawara and Zielinski. And he's got players like Marco Rose or Raj and Unas, the winger, that he just didn't use, or at least use enough, especially considering they were in a lot of competitions to start the season. So who got more out of their squad? That would be Allegri. I look at Allegri taking a player that I love, Alessandro, thinking to himself, all right, well, we're a little weak. Yeah, of course I have to. But this time it really fits my narrative here. You know, Allegri looks and, all right, we have some injuries up front. What are we going to do? You know what? I'm going to put Alessandro up front just like I put Dani Alves up front last year. And I can have Kwadwo Asamoah fill in at left back. Center backs, he's rotated those and he's done really damn well with that. I think that Allegri is a master of rotation, and Sarri is pretty much the complete opposite. One could say, yeah, Napoli had an incredible season, and look what Sarri squeezed out of them, but I don't know. I'm taking it literally. I think Allegri got more out of his squad simply because he used all of his pieces better than Sarri did. So that's my opinion. David, what about you?
You make a lot of interesting points, and I think you answered this quite literally, which, and I think there's nothing wrong with that. So I agree with a lot of it. So I'm going to break it down and kind of make the case for each and then wrap it up at the end. So let's start with Juve. So they started the season with the big loss of Bonucci, and a lot of people were saying, okay, Juve shifted the focus from defense to offense. I think most people would agree that Juve's midfield wasn't improved probably enough. Matuidi certainly had his moments, but there really wasn't a game changer in the midfield when almost everyone would have said that was the issue with the team. On the other hand, Juve really had a great attack this season. Douglas Costa ended up being fantastic. Bernardeschi, granted, didn't start a ton of matches, did quite well. Juve's offense was just loaded. So when I look at what Allegri did, I think he did a really good job compensating for Bonucci's loss, compensating for the midfield not being improved enough. I mean, he's about to win another Scudetto, I think, in the Champions League. The performance at the Santiago Bernabeu and almost winning that match, I think you'd have to be very happy with that as a whole. Now, I will say a lot of people will point to Juve not having a brilliant season as far as style of play, and even some big matches where we expected Juve just to finally hit the gas pedal and try to go all out and get the most out of their offensive attack. We can't really say that they did that. But at the end of the day, Allegri still won the title. On the flip side for Napoli, you pointed out how Sarri didn't use some quality players. I'm going to die on the hill that Napoli actually did have pretty good depth. On the other hand, they also did lose two key players. Ghulam's injury really can't be understated. Twice hurt his knee, really a key player for them. I think Milik, who really played well when healthy, would have really given them an opportunity to rotate a lot more in the attack. We saw Mertens really run out of gas. Now, the flip side is also because Sarri didn't use a lot of his bench players, it was hard for Napoli to get reinforcements in the January window. And I've pointed that as really one of the reasons why they didn't end up winning the title. But that was part of Sarri's mistake there too, not getting the most out of his squad. And now I know a lot of people are going to point to the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, Napoli only got 1 point in the matches with Fiorentina and Torino, and in a lot of ways that's ultimately why they're not winning the title. But I also want to point out that as it stands now, Napoli right now has 85 points. There are two games to go in the season. During this cycle of Juve wins, they've won the titles three times with 87 points or less. So odds are is Napoli is going to match that total and get to at least 87 points, which almost any other year would get you the title. So all things considered, I can make a great case that Sarri maybe got more out of his squad when you consider that. But at the end of the day, I really think that both Allegri and Sarri really deserve a lot of credit. They've really pushed themselves in the sense that it's almost an unfair standard. For Napoli, there's all this talk about they choked, they gave away the title, but I think it's much more to do with the fact that Juve is so relentless and dominating in Serie A. So in that sense, you can also point to Allegri. So this is a long and short for me to say that I don't have an exact answer, but I just think both of them have raised the standard so high that I think a lot of the criticism that they receive is a little bit unwarranted. So now let's shift gears. We have the Coppa Italia final coming up on Wednesday. We're recording this on Monday. So Alex, I want to ask you more in terms of this. Let's say Milan wins the Coppa Italia. How much does that make up for the rest of the disappointment of the season? I think, you know, after the great summer transfer window that Milan had and that we covered here, I think anything short of a Champions League spot would have been a disappointment for Milan. So how much do you think a potential win in the Coppa Italia would make up for that?
Honestly, I think that would be huge for Milan. If they come away at the end of the season with no Europa League spot, and no trophy from the Coppa Italia, well, that blows. But honestly, if they can win the Coppa Italia, especially against Juventus, the team that now has the Scudetto pretty much in hand, now they're once again the mighty giant, if they can take that away from Juve, that would be huge. And it would make the season a lot less disappointing. Hey, Milan, I hate to say this for all the Milan fans out there, they haven't won a trophy, a really important trophy, in a while. Sure, they won the Italian Super Cup last year, but overall, they haven't won the league since 2010-11. They haven't won this Coppa Italia since 2002-03. So they need a title like this. They really do, and they deserve it. They do deserve it. They're such an important franchise to Serie A and really all of world football. Yeah, maybe they could have made things easier on themselves if they had made maybe a few less acquisitions and just honed in on a cohesive unit, but they did have their spurts this year. They probably do deserve to get that Europa League spot. Atalanta, of course, is right behind them. I think that would be massive if they get the Coppa Italia. And honestly, I can kind of relate as a Chelsea fan. I know Chelsea won the Premier League last year, but it's been an up and down season for Chelsea too. I'm sure Milan fans and Chelsea fans can actually share and sympathize on a couple things this year. And Chelsea have the chance to win the FA Cup, their League Cup, and that would be huge. It would really be nice to come away with some silverware like that. I think it would be huge for AC Milan if they can somehow beat Juve and win the Coppa Italia. So that's my opinion. What about you, David?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the Super Cup that they won with Montella. And I'm with you. To me, the Coppa Italia is much more prestigious because, for one, Milan was in that Super Cup just because of a technicality. They hadn't won the Coppa Italia themselves, and they played in that game and they won on penalty kicks. So I think that would be definitely a more, I'm not saying not like the Super Cup wasn't legitimate, but this would be more of a journey that they completed. I think it'd be very important for Gattuso to finish the season with a trophy, because look, there's been a lot of talk that maybe Milan jumped the gun by giving him an extension, you know, during the season. I go back to the fact that realistically, I'm not sure they would have been able to get a better candidate, but that's just my opinion. But I think it would be be very important for him to finish the season with that. And I think that does give him some momentum going into the summer transfer window. And hey, it would also be a very big win from Milan Twitter. I'm sure if they were to win the Coppa Italia, we're going to hear a lot about it. And there's something to be said about that as well. So the game's on Wednesday. We'll definitely talk about this on Thursday. So let's see what happens.
All right, David. Well, the Serie A season is definitely coming to a close, but we just had a nice weekend of calcio. So without further ado, who are winners and losers of episode 110 of the Calcioland podcast?
So this week I wanted to do it a little bit differently, because basically what I've been doing in recent weeks is I basically update this list as I'm watching the games, and I think I kind of missed the big picture. So I'll give you the big picture first, and then we'll narrow more into the micro. Big winners for the week, of course, Juve basically clinched the title. I mean, it's just a mathematical thing that they haven't. So big win for them. Inter, big win against Udinese. They've helped their chances in the race for a Champions League spot. Same with Roma. Didn't play particularly well, but they did beat Cagliari. Very important for them there. For the race for the Europa League, we had Fiorentina with a big win at Genoa, despite a goal by their former player Giuseppe Rossi, and Atalanta, who've been really impressive this season, traveled to Rome, and they got a draw against Lazio. So they're still in the race for a Europa League spot. And with the race that's really fascinating is the race to avoid relegation. What a roller coaster ride it's been in recent weeks. Chievo, who we almost thought were waving the right flag and just accepting that they were going back down to the second division with a huge win. Spal, to another big win. So they're kind of getting out of the danger zone. So they are definitely winners. As far as players, I got quite a few. Milan, their impressive win against Hellas Verona, Cutrone, Calhanoglu, Bonaventura all had big games. Douglas Costa, absolutely brilliant for Juve. And a lot of people were questioning why Allegri had him on the bench. I have to say, as I was watching the game, I was like, look, if Douglas Costa comes in and destroys this match, it's not that Allegri nailed the sub. It's more of a matter that maybe he messed up his starting lineup. But then Allegri in the post-game match pointed out that Douglas Costa just had a kid and hadn't slept much the night before, and he had only limited energy. Not sure if that's true, but doesn't change the fact that Douglas Costa was absolutely brilliant when he came in. Inter's win against Udinese, we had Ranocchia scoring a goal because Miranda was a late scratch. Rafinha with another brilliant performance. Napoli, obviously, disappointing result against Torino, but at least Mertens had his first goal in 8 matches. In the match between Lazio and Atalanta, we had some goals by intriguing strikers. Barro, who's been really good, this young striker for Atalanta, who's been playing a lot recently, been brilliant, had another goal. And we had Immobile's replacement, because Immobile's hurt right now. Caicedo had a goal off a brilliant assist by Luis Alberto. In that Napoli-Torino match, we had Jajic, who's been really in great form the past few matches, has another good performance. Now, Jajic, the only thing that's consistent is his inconsistency, but man, when he's on, he's devastating. Another winner we mentioned, Pepito Rossi, got the start for Genoa, scored against his former team, quite the moment for him. Spal's match, big win in the race to avoid relegation. We had Paloschi, who was their big summer acquisition, with a key goal for them. We mentioned Chievo Birsa, who I think is a very good player. He had been benched past few matches, had the game winner for them. And same for Sassuolo, Politano had the game that mathematically made sure they avoided relegation. So those are our winners for the weekend. On the flip side, it's hard not to mention Napoli as a loser just for this specific week. Like, look, it's easy to say, look, they choked the Scudetto with the Fiorentina and Torino matches. At the same time, over the course of a season, teams do have up and down. Napoli did have enough points to win the title, but it's also about when you get these points and when the pressure really came on to Napoli. They probably didn't handle it the best they could. As far as the race to avoid relegation, Cagliari now finds themselves, right now they'd be relegated if the season just ended. You wouldn't have said that a few weeks ago. Udinese continues to struggle despite the coaching change with Tudor. Crotone lost against Chievo. They're still in trouble for the race to avoid relegation, and Sampdoria are basically out of a Europa League spot. I also want to highlight the fact that Hellas Verona, I mean, what a poor performance against Milan. It feels like they nailed in the entire season. So disappointing there. I had them pegged as the one team coming up from Serie B that I expected to do better, and boy, was I wrong about that. So now that we have winners and losers out of the way, let's get into the great Twitter questions. I have to say this week we have some really good ones. If you want to send in questions for the podcast, please use the CalcioLand hashtag. Which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David. Well, I know a lot of my fellow Chelsea fans are really wondering, what is the latest on Maurizio Sarri's future?
I actually have some exciting news on this. So over the weekend, there was a lot going on with Sarri and Napoli. So Napoli's president, De Laurentiis, who's a movie producer, knows the entertainment business really well, gave a bunch of interviews. Some of them were pretty contradictory. In a lot of ways, he was blaming the season on Sarri, saying that too many of the players were tired and they ran out of gas, and why should I buy players if he's not going to use them? He did say that he would like to keep going with Sarri, but there is that exit clause valued 8 million euros that needs to be exercised in May. So we're going to know this month what's going to happen with Sarri. Sarri, on the other hand, keeps putting it back on Napoli, saying, look, it's up to them. If they want to keep me, if they want to keep the core players, I'll stay, but I have to be part of the project and I have to have confidence. I'm actually writing a column today on Sarri, will be posted tomorrow, because there's really a lot to the situation. Now, I will tell you, because I knew people would ask on the podcast and I'm writing a column, I did ask a person who knows things, and it's not Di Marzio, but someone who definitely knows a lot of these things about Sarri. And his response was, you know, I know there's a lot of talk about Chelsea, but don't underestimate Monaco as a destination for Sarri. Makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, Monte Carlo, Monaco is right close to Italy. It's really on the border. Sarri, you know, I see him as really someone who really strives in the Italian society and whatnot. They're a team that is used to young players. There might be a little bit less pressure. They're all about the playing, the style of football, attractive style of football. So don't be surprised if that's a place he ends up at. I still think there's a good chance that Napoli keeps him. I go back to the fact that it's very easy to sack a coach. It's much harder to find someone better. I'm not sure realistically who Napoli could get that is better than Sarri, but we are going to find out. So let's see what happens, but just don't count out Monaco as a destination for Sarri.
Damn, with the talent that Monaco has, they'd be one fun team to watch. And you love Keita Balde. He would do really well under Sarri. All right, staying on Sarri, does the fact that Sarri played numerous prospects at Empoli prove that he wouldn't necessarily be as stubborn with the same lineup as he has been at Napoli?
This is a good question, and it came in the context of your team, Chelsea, because, of course, as you know, Alex, and that you are really bullish on Chelsea's young talent, a lot of people are saying, hey, you know, I know a lot of people say Sarri's stubborn with his lineup at Napoli, but hey, at Empoli, he was using these young players. Do you think he would do it at Chelsea? But here's the thing. Like, I think what's happening at Napoli is much more representative of how Sarri would act at a big club with the expectations of trying to win in the short term. Because look, at Empoli, Sarri had a squad, basically what they gave him, mix of youth, veteran players. He did have, you know, some older players. He was developing Rugani. There was Hizaj, who then followed him at Napoli. But I don't think it was really a matter of Sarri saying, you know, I have this philosophy, I'm going to stick to it. It was really more at Empoli, they gave him the players that he had. He had to get the best out of them. Now, at Napoli, he did have a mix of young players. I'm going to die on the hill that they had good depth, but he stuck to his starting lineup. And I think if he had a lot of pressure to produce results, I'm wondering how much he learned from this season, if he would change a little bit his approach. I think too, you know, let's say hypothetically he goes to Chelsea, maybe the club tells him, look, the only reason we hired you is we saw what you did with Koulibaly and Jorginho. We want you to do the same with our guys. And granted, those players are a little bit older, but there's definitely a track record of Sarri improving players. So short of him going to a place where they tell him, look, we don't care if you really win trophies, it's about developing, I have a feeling he would stick more to what we saw at Napoli than Empoli.
And it's definitely a concern of mine if Sarri were to take over at Chelsea. I absolutely would love the aesthetically pleasing football, but people know, I love Chelsea's youth. And if they don't get integrated soon, I'm going to be very frustrated. My plan of attack is hire Sarri and then don't get any other players. So he's forced to play some youth players. So your squad is extra thin because he'll probably neglect them if you give him a really good starting lineup. All right, David.
Don't teach him English. Tell him that there'll just be a translator that will handle everything. And when he starts saying outrageous things, the translator can just say something else. That would be my other advice.
Oh, I love it. England would eat it up. Eat it up. All right, next Twitter question. The Independent, Daily Mail, and The Sun are all reporting that Milinkovic-Savic will join Man U for $80 million. David, any thoughts on the odds of this happening, and how would he fit there?
You know that the transfer window is coming once David starts replying on Twitter. We don't discuss the reports of others. So here we are. So I'm going to tell you guys, I know if you get annoyed with that answer, and trust me, I get annoyed having to type it out too. Check out my columns on ESPN because, to be honest, that's the one time a week where I'm basically doing that. So to answer this gentleman's question, I got bombarded with tweets because I guess there were reports in England on the deal between Manchester United and Lazio for Milinkovic-Savic. This is news to me. There's been nothing really about this, not just on Di Marzio's side, but in general in Italy. Look, I think regardless of Lazio making the Champions League or not, the odds are more likely than not that Milinkovic-Savic is leaving. So I'm not saying that we need to see how Lazio's season ends for those transfer rumors to heat up. But I have a hard time imagining that Lazio in this specific time is really focused on this. Same with Milinkovic-Savic. I think he's been on a really strong tear recently. I think he wants to finish the season strong. On the bright side for Manchester United, if he's sold, he is going to a super rich club. So there aren't too many teams that Man United would be competing with, but I'm not even sure if 80 million euros is enough. I'm not sure if this was pounds or euros. I think he's going at least for Pogba money, if not more. So that's the bright side. As far as how he would fit Manchester United, look, I've been one of the people that has talked about the comparisons between him and Pogba. There are some pretty obvious ones, but Milinkovic-Savic is so versatile that I think he could fit in really anywhere. So I wouldn't be too concerned. With Pogba, it can work. I think it could, but there's going to be a lot of suitors for him, and I just think it's a little bit premature to say it's a done deal that he's going to a specific team. There will be a lot of time to speculate about this in the summer, on this podcast too, by the way.
That would absolutely work. You take two unbelievably complete CMs like those two. If a manager can't make that work, shame on them. Shame on them. All right, next question, David. How would Sami Khedira fit in the Premier League?
So over the weekend on Saturday, Di Marzio's site was down. And I don't really tweet that many quotes anymore. If I tweet stuff, it's usually an article. Once in a while, I'll tweet an opinion. But I did post this quote by Khedira because I found it pretty interesting. Basically, he said that, you know, he's got 1 year left with Juve. He really likes it there, but he's always looking for leagues where he hasn't played yet and wants to add to his trophy case in different leagues. And he mentioned specifically the Premier League as a place that he'd like to play. Those who remember when he signed with Juve, Arsenal were in the mix too. So it really wouldn't surprise me. And I think, you know, Allegri really values Khedira. I don't think most Juve fans do. So it wouldn't shock me if Juve tries to move him over the summer. But what was really interesting is when I tweeted this quote, like the difference in takes, like Premier League fans were really eager to say, oh, it's great. Let's hope he comes here, sign him up Manchester United, sign him up Arsenal, sign him up Chelsea. All fans of different teams. But Juve fans on the other fans were like, go, we can't wait. Please go. So I found that quite interesting. Now, I will say that Khedira, I think he deserves a lot of credit in the big matches. He's had some big moments for Juve when it matters most. Maybe, you know, he's saving his energy for these moments. So I think he still has something to give, but I'm just not sure Premier League fans who haven't followed him closely at Serie A realize the level that he's on. So it wouldn't shock me if he leaves, but I don't think you're getting vintage Khedira. You might still get some great performances in big matches, though.
All right, well, let's move to another Juve player. This is an interesting one. Can Lichtsteiner be considered a Juventus legend?
All right, I'm going to get on my soapbox, Alex. So here we go. And I was thinking a lot of Dre Cordero on tribalism and how fans react. So there was a lot of debate on Twitter on is Lichtsteiner a Juve legend, and I want to specify a Juve legend. And I think every time I brought up, look, he was a great player, great Juventino. The way I would describe Lick Steiner is he's the typical player that he's on your team. You love him because the guy will literally do anything to win. Can be a little bit dirty at times, you know, will literally go the extra level to win. So when he's on your team, you love him. But as an opponent, he's the type of guy you really, really hate. So I'd say that as a compliment. I think too, he really embodies the workmanlike qualities we love at Juve, the grinta, that word that you, Alex, love as well. We've seen it with a lot of great Juve players. I just think of Conte and Deschamps being two players that really embody that. And I think in a lot of ways, it's easy to kind of value the player that you're like, man, this guy's given us everything. I love this guy. I also think Lick Steiner came at a very good time for his personal brand. Juve had really struggled before he arrived. They had some terrible right backs, Grigera, Motta. Lick Steiner arrives, a huge upgrade over them. He's won a title every single year, been an important player for them, no doubt about it. So I'm not disputing that he's not a great Juventino, but legend is a big word, especially at Juve. Like, I challenge anyone, if Lick Steiner's a legend, what are we going to call players like Buffon and Del Piero? When I think of, like, Juve legends, like, I think of, like, a couple of tiers. For me, there's, like, the old-timers, Buffon, Del Piero, Boniperti, Sivori, players like that. Then there's a next tier with, like, Ballon d'Or winners and really iconic players at the club. Think of Michel Platini, Robbie Baggio, Pavel Nedved, Gaetano Scirea, John Charles. Like, those are Juve legends to me. Like, I don't want to discredit Lick Steiner. Again, great Juventino, but there have been a lot of players that fit his criteria at Juve in years past, and there will be more. When I think of a legend, it's really someone like almost irreplicable. And I think of someone like Buffon and Del Piero for a variety of reasons. It's hard to replicate them. For those that know Juve's history, Furino is a player that falls under that category. Scirea, like, just to it, but how his life ended. A great defender who never got a yellow card. Like, that to me is legend. So it's no offense to Lick Steiner. I'm not saying he's not great, but I think with Juve fans, when they hear me saying, maybe not a legend, they read, oh, he's saying that he sucks. That's not at all what I'm saying. But when I look at Juve's history, I think that's really giving him a little bit too much credit. I also think, you know, specifically at wing back position, you know, is he better than, say, Antonio Cabrini, the great left back from the 80s that won the World Cup? Is he better than Thuram? And I know Juve fans don't like the way he left, but that's one of the best right backs of all times. Is he better than, say, Angelo Di Livio, a player he has a lot in common, like the little soldier that ran up and down the pitch on the flank? Like, when I think of Di Livio, I used to watch him play at Padova in the Curva. To me, Di Livio is a Padova legend because of the club standard, but he's not a Juve legend. So that's kind of the approach that I have with Lick Steiner. I bet you a lot of people heard this as me saying Lick Steiner sucks, but I just have a very high bar for what makes a Juve legend.
Yeah, I'm in agreement, David. And to piggyback off of it, to compare it to American sports, and even though they're saying a Juve legend, I think to even be considered a legend at your own club, at least individually, you should be on the level in American sports of making a couple All-Star games, or were you in an MVP discussion 1 year? And Lick Steiner's been a real nice player for Juve, but he's never even been at the top tier of right backs, even really for a year. So great Juve player, but I totally agree, not a legend. Next Twitter question, where does Allegri rank compared to Lippi and Capello?
I love this question because I will tell you, for when I see, you know, Allegri, his game management in the Champions League and the way he manages over two legs, like that brilliant tactical approach, he really reminds me a lot about Lippi. And, you know, everyone points to the 2006 World Cup, the way Lippi managed that squad. But even at his heyday at Juve, how great Lippi was tactically. So I definitely see a lot of comparisons to him. But even Capello, in the sense that Capello's team, there was a lot of the same criticism that we have with Allegri now. Like, Capello's team was loaded talent-wise. He had Ibrahimovic, Del Piero, and Trezeguet up front, just loaded. And a lot of teams were like, he just didn't get the most out of it. And I think that's a lot of the criticism that you can give to Allegri. Now, I will say, Capello's team should have done better in the Champions League because they were probably the best team for sure in Europe. I'm not sure we could say that for Allegri's Juve, but I think there are some parallels with the negative style of play, not getting the most out of your best players. So I think he's kind of a combination of the two.
All right, it's ranking time, David. Who have been the top five goalkeepers in Serie A this season?
So great. I like this question. So guys, before I answer this, I've been tweeting some questions. I'm doing a lot of research for our year-end podcast rankings and even for my preparation for my transfer window. So if you follow me on Twitter, check out the series of questions that I asked on the best players on each team. I appreciate your input. So this was a great question. It made me think on the five best goalkeepers in Serie A. For CERN, we have Alisson, number one for sure. I think we can. This is the best keepers of the season, so not the best goalkeeper talent-wise. I'm talking strictly performance this season. I think we can safely put Handanovic on Inter as well. I think after that, we can probably put Lazio goalkeeper Strakosha. Has been quite good this season. Of the teams trying to avoid relegation, Sorrentino on Chievo has had a lot of brilliant matches. So I almost have those four as locks. For the last spot, I was kind of thinking I have a trio of Perin at Genoa, Viviano at Sampdoria, and Sportiello at Fiorentina. So I would think strictly performance this season. I'm going to take the four I mentioned first and one out of these. I think what you will notice what really stands out are the names that are missing. I think Szczesny's been really good when he played for Juve, but he wasn't a full-time starter. I think Buffon has made some mistakes here or there. He hasn't been as bad as people make him out to be, but I'm not sure. And it also has a lot to do with opportunity. When you're Juve's keeper, you're not going to get a ton of shots on goal like Sorrentino does at Chievo. So it's really the omissions and Donnarumma. Like, I really think this hasn't been the best season for Donnarumma. He hasn't been bad, but he hasn't been as ridiculously good as he's been in the year past. So that's my list. I'm curious to hear your take on the goalkeepers, and also please check out my tweets and give me your input.
All right, next Twitter question. After Napoli and Roma's impressive runs in Serie A and Champions League, respectively, can this be seen as the end of an era or the beginning of a cycle? And who do you expect to be Juve's biggest rival next season?
These are great questions, man. I really like these. And man, how things have changed. Not long ago, I was advocating for Roma to blow it up, start over. But now with all the revenues from the Champions League, and we had John Solano on telling us that Roma actually is going to have the ability to keep a lot of their best players, something they weren't able to do in the past. So I'm going to say between the two, I think Roma is probably starting their cycle. With Napoli, we already talked all the uncertainty with Sarri. It's really a little bit hard to tell. Our friend Matteo Bonetti said that, look, if Napoli didn't win it this year, they would take a step back and it would take them a while to get back. It's possible that that's the case. So I think next season, Roma is going to be Juve's biggest foe. I'm always bullish on Inter every year, and they don't get it together. So let's see what happens. But my guess are Roma and Inter. I just think Milan has too much work to do, and I'm worried that Napoli is going to take a step back.
Okay, next one. Should the Italian Federation bring in foreign referees for huge games to help combat all the conspiracies?
I love this idea. I think it's terrific. And I think we should take it a step further, and we should like let teams kind of pick the referee or something, bring in that referee from the Real Madrid match for Juve, or the one from Liverpool for Roma. I'm just joking, but this is actually an interesting idea. But to me, that would almost be an admission that or the league is rigged, or people are just so crazy thinking that the league is rigged that we have to do something about it. But I kind of like this idea. It's really thinking outside the box. I don't have a good answer, but I wanted to mention it because I like this idea.
Yeah, why not? Let's do it. I mean, don't they do it in international games? They always make sure it's somebody who doesn't hail from that country. It's not that crazy of an idea. Let's get wild. All right, David, last Twitter question. Should Serie A fans boycott ESPN after the recent Roma coverage on ESPN FC?
So I love this question. And look, full disclosure, you guys know I cover the transfer window for ESPN in the summer and in January. I can only speak for myself. I've only had amazing experiences with them. It's been a very rewarding thing. And I'm not a person that shits where they eat. So I'm not going to overly criticize them, but I will say it is great that Serie A fans are really speaking up in such strong ways to demand better and more fair coverage. What I will say about the segments on ESPN FC, and if you've been following on social media, Roma's official account have made fun of it. President Pallotta has gone after them. When I saw those segments, this is precisely why I never talk about things that I don't know much about, because a lot of times you can end up looking this way. Now, I also get you're a pundit on TV. You have to cover these things in the Champions League. Maybe you're not that familiar with Serie A, but maybe you should kind of account for that. So I try never to speak about things I don't know much about, because I think that's the potential of it coming off that way. The other thing I'll say is, look, you guys know I'm friendly with a lot of people at BN Sport. We've had a lot of them on the podcast. I think, though, and I'm not the type of person to criticize, you know, things publicly, which might impact my friends. But I do think, again, it's fantastic that Serie A fans are speaking up and demanding better coverage. It all comes down to we all have to keep doing it in a way where promote Serie A. Let's keep tuning into Serie A matches so it gets better ratings. Let's keep the shows like ESPN FC that occasionally cover Serie A, ask them to do more. I really think that nowadays the consumer is really the king. There are so many avenues for you to consume sports, so you can really decide what gets put on the air or not by what you support and be vocal about it. So I think it's great that Serie A fans have been more vocal, and I think as a result of that, we are going to get better coverage of the league. So I want to thank you guys for the Twitter questions. We really had some great ones. Keep sending them in as usual. Serie A transfers from around the globe. We didn't do any music, TV, or films today, but we take those as well. So without further ado, we have an interview with our good friend Ben Golliver. So full disclosure, for the rest of the podcast, there is no calcio talk at all. So don't tweet at me that I wasted your time. I'm telling you right now, you're not interested in NBA. You're not interested in journalism. You can tune off now. But this is a great interview. We really got into some high-level stories in the NBA. We really got into journalism and podcasting. If you're looking to improve the reach of your podcast or improve your articles, I think you'll get some great tips, because Ben Golliver is someone that I really look up to, and this was a really fun conversation. So while we've been very busy on the podcast covering an exciting finish to the Serie A season, in the NBA, the playoffs are been going on. They're absolutely on fire. Really, really exciting time to follow the NBA. So we figured we'd do a quick change of pace instead of the usual calcio talk. I was very glad that our good friend of the show, Ben Golliver, is back. We've had him on a few times before. Those of you that are familiar with his work know that he's one of the writers for Sports Illustrated on the NBA. He's one of the two people in charge of their vaunted 100 Best Player list. He is the co-host of one of my favorite podcasts on the NBA called Open Floor. So I'm excited to have Ben on. We're going to talk about the NBA, but also about journalism, podcasting, writing, because he is one of the people that I really enjoy kind of stealing stuff from, because he really does a great job. So with that long intro, Ben, it's a real pleasure to have you back on Calcioland. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, man. How you doing?
Doing great. I am doing great. So I wanted to talk to you, Ben, a little bit about these playoffs. And I've been following you for a while, and I think I actually know that I'm a little bit older than you. I've been following the NBA since the mid-80s. I started on Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, been following the league since then. And, you know, you've been around for a while, too, and you've been covering it professionally for SI for a while. So I wanted to get your take. A lot of people are describing this as the golden age of the NBA. Would you say this is the most exciting time for you to cover the league since you've been doing it?
Yeah, this is always a tough one for me to answer. It's sort of like comparing your children, you know, and I also think I'm a little warped, because I think I'm so deep into the rabbit hole of the NBA that even if it was like Magic Suns in the NBA Finals, I'd still be, you know, getting really excited and talking myself into it. I'm not sure I'm completely unbiased in terms of that, but the NBA has been on an absolutely amazing run here. I mean, you look at some of the finals they've had in recent years, they've been excellent. Obviously, the Warriors reaching new heights has been great for the league. But to me, doesn't this boil down to just we're in the era of LeBron And on a nightly basis, this guy has delivered basically year after year after year after year. And it's very hard to talk because, you know, the comparison always on the court between Jordan and LeBron is going to get, you know, really tense and people are going to compare their resumes. But I think when you're looking at the overall fan experience or the overall observer experience, if you want to throw media in there too, we just have so much more access to LeBron than we ever did to Jordan. Everything he's doing off the court. We've got his son this morning trash talking with Drake on Instagram. I mean, it's a completely immersive experience. And so it really goes beyond just what's happening on the basketball court. And I don't know if you've ever played this hypothetical game, but I was thinking about this morning. Now, imagine if LeBron just never came along and the amount of ripple effects that would have. I mean, even look at the teams that are like in the playoffs right now. Like, for example, Boston. You know, do they ever break up the Paul George and the Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett team when they did? If LeBron doesn't exist, you know, they probably don't. And so that means they don't have that huge trade with Brooklyn, and their organization's in a very different place right now. You could argue the Sixers wouldn't have gone through the process at the same point, and maybe they would say, hey, we have a chance to actually compete in the Eastern Conference, and they don't tear it down when they did. That team would look differently. I mean, the huge narrative right now is Toronto is a bunch of chokers, right? Well, maybe they make the finals one year, and they're not a bunch of chokers if LeBron never comes along. And you can kind of go right down the list. You know, does Kevin Durant ever leave Oklahoma City? He probably wins a title at some point. Maybe the Warriors look a little bit different. Who knows? The Harden trade. I mean, all these things could all, you know, maybe have been, you know, I guess, you know, taking place differently had LeBron not come along. So I think that's what makes this current era so special for the NBA, is that LeBron's just tentacles reach in every direction around the league. He's changing all these guys' legacies in terms of how many titles they win, how much success they have in the postseason. And, you know, he continues to just do it. I mean, the game winner the other night was phenomenal, and that's hard to top.
Yeah, a lot of interesting stuff there. I think, you know, like you mentioned, there's just so much talent. You and I, before we started recording, are talking about how many great rookies there are. So it's a combination of so much talent, and the league really deserves so much talent for how they've embraced social media, how they use, you know, even print media like you and podcasting. I mean, it's truly unbelievable. It's such a fun time to watch the league. So let me ask you a couple of hypothetical questions on some players that really stand out to me. I know for those that aren't that familiar with your work, you've been talking about Giannis on the Bucks for years now. You've been telling us how great he's going to be. I think this year has really been his coming out party. On the other hand, another player who, of course, is getting a ton of attention is Anthony Davis, who this year I feel really has reached his apex. So I'm going to ask you, as someone that really knows these players and is really into both of them, like a complete hypothetical. This has nothing to do with the Celtics having all the assets to potentially pull a trade off like this, but I have a feeling Anthony Davis would get a little bit more in a trade, but how close would it be? Like, what types of packages do you think players like that would get? And this is really considering everything, their age, current contract, injury history, and whatnot.
Yeah, I think Davis certainly would get more. I think he's a little bit easier to build around because he's not like the world's greatest three-point shooter, but he definitely has the ability to space now. And I think for Giannis, you know, he's running into that wall that kind of gets a lot of these guys. And it was a knock on LeBron early in his career too, is like, you know, how much do you trust his three-point shooting? And for Giannis, you don't trust it at all. And it puts him into a situation where his team's overall offense, you know, really can't reach its ceiling because he's often in situations where he has to settle for the tough twos, and he's a master at creating easy twos, you know, going to the basket, finishing and all of that. But, you know, he's still not fully developed offensively where he needs to be. And Davis has just gotten over some of those hurdles, and, you know, he works seamlessly with basically any package of teammates. I mean, you look at what they've done in New Orleans. They've had a nice run here, you know, grabbing a guy like Mirotic and picking up Rondo. But I mean, these are not like, you know, superstar level players, and Davis is taking them, and, you know, they gave Golden State a shot there in game three, and that was impressive. So to answer your question, well, the first thing I would do is I challenge the premise, because I think Davis is now in the point here where guys like myself have been throwing him around in trade talks for basically the last 2 or 3 years straight.
Yeah.
And I think this run for New Orleans has really removed him from that conversation, because the reason why he was in those trade talks is we were always assuming he wasn't going to be happy. At some point, the expiration date would hit. They wouldn't be able to, you know, put the winning team around him. and he would just want to hit the eject button. I don't know about you, but I've never seen Davis look happier, more content with his teammates. And, you know, they're already thinking about what they could become next year after they've really had time to, like, you know, gel this thing together and, you know, potentially bring, you know, DeMarcus Cousins back from the injury. So I think he could actually be one of those situations where the trade package that they would actually accept is so ludicrously high that basically no one could reach it. And he just kind of gets into that untouchable category. But what we're looking at for either one of these guys based on their age, I mean, I think you're talking about multiple high-level prospects, multiple first-round picks to kind of even get the conversation going. They've both got enough time left on, you know, their contracts where, you know, they're pristine, you know, type assets, you know, they're franchise building type assets. And so it won't be a situation like, say, Jimmy Butler, where you didn't really get a great pick or a great player back in that deal if you're Chicago. I mean, I think the bar would be significantly higher for both those guys. And with Davis, you know, he's definitely at least, you know, one really quality asset, I think, better than Giannis, whether that's a young prospect who's got, you know, star potential or, you know, a quality first round pick. I would kind of set the difference between their market values, you know, that way. But I also would be shocked if Davis finds himself in any trade rumors here over the next like 18 months or so. I mean, I think they've really solidified that franchise, that direction, you know, over the last 4 or 5 months. And I didn't see that coming. I mean, when Cousins went down, I thought, this means we're going to spend all summer talking about Anthony Davis trades and it's going to be, you know, just a whirlwind. And instead it's been the exact opposite.
What do you think Milwaukee is going to try to do to, because you mentioned how much the situation has improved in New Orleans and how Davis now has really no big incentive to leave. What do you think Milwaukee has to do to kind of get into that same place with their superstar?
Well, the thing that you always want to do in these situations is look at what is your superstar's greatest skill and build around them. And we can look at an example like Houston. They've masterfully done that around James Harden. He's a great offensive player, kind of a, you know, so-so or worse defensive player. And what did they do? They spent the next 3 years basically, you know, once he got in there and got settled, trying to make him the best possible offensive player that he could be, finding the right teammates to accentuate his strengths and build the whole show around him. And you can argue kind of the same thing has happened in New Orleans with Davis. It just kind of was a, you know, a roundabout way of getting there. You know, they tried the Cousins thing, but the last couple of months, what you've seen is Davis's greatest strengths, the versatility, the athleticism, the speed, just the matchup nightmare nature of his game has been fully unleashed because, you know, Alvin Gentry is a coach who wants to run up and down the court and really play fast. And that, you know, goes right into Davis's strengths. So when I look at Giannis, he's amazing in the open court. He doesn't get into the open court nearly enough. He's amazing when he's able to attack one-on-one in space and get to the rim. He's very difficult for guys to handle. He's not as amazing when things bog down, when their, you know, their offense turns into sort of one-on-one isolation, turnarounds, you know, that kind of stuff, or my turn, your turn stuff with Chris Middleton. That's when it gets less exciting. So for me, I would be looking at a coach like, you know, Mike Budenholzer, the old Hawks coach, to try to get some more of this like Spurs style or even like the modern Sixers style basketball where the ball is hopping, but you're also really putting a premium on space and interchangeable wings. And you're just kind of basically turning Giannis loose as a, you know, kind of the head of the machine. And they've tried to do that in Milwaukee. Obviously Jason Kidd empowered Giannis to sort of be that lead ball handler. And that was a good first step, but I think they need to take it to the next step and, you know, get a situation where he is able to do the same types of things one-on-one that Harden's been doing and where their overall team style really looks, you know, in his making. You know, in other words, we're not just seeing one dunk per game in transition and thinking, oh, wow, look at Giannis. He can take three steps from half court and dunk. Where we're seeing that consistently, where they're always putting that pace pressure on you as a defense and you're always having to deal with him in transition. That's how I want to see them play.
So you mentioned how in Houston is setting up Harden to succeed, and you've said it before, and you know I think a lot of people have noticed this year D'Antoni has changed a little bit his style, become a little bit more of a classic conservative NBA coach, little less, more I guess more emphasis on defense and more, you know, more I would say classic style. How much of an impact do you think that's had on the team's success, and can that help them finally, you know, go deeper into the playoffs than they have in year past?
Yeah, I think it's a sign of progress from D'Antoni because he's often been one of those guys who just sticks to his script and doesn't want to change his philosophy in years past. But who I really give the credit to is Chris Paul showing up, because a great example is like this playoff series against Utah right now. Now, last year, Houston gets into the showdown with San Antonio. San Antonio breaks out this defense where they basically say, we're going to take away James Harden's threes as much as possible, and we're going to plant the defender in front of the rim, and we're going to dare them to shoot mid-range shots. And D'Antoni was so, you know, stuck on the threes and layups philosophy that they basically did not adjust. That's why they lose that series, is they never found a way to sort of unlock that defense. Well, you know, along comes this season, Utah tries to basically do the same thing. They have success, and they beat Houston once. What you see immediately afterwards, the very next game, in back-to-back wins in Utah, what you see is Chris Paul's presence attacking those situations. And when they are giving them those mid-range shots they didn't want to take last year, Chris Paul shooting them over and over and over and over. I think in game three, he hit 5 mid-range shots. I think in game four, he hit 9, which is an absurd total. I mean, there's been, you know, that's almost like a month's worth of mid-range shots for Houston, you know, maybe last year or the year before. I mean, they just completely avoid those shots like the plague. And here's Paul just dicing up the Jazz's defense because, you know, Rudy Gobert is essentially daring him to take those shots rather than get to the basket. And I think that shows a flexibility from D'Antoni. I think it shows a flexibility from their front office, which has really, you know, driven home those points about what are high efficiency shots. But it also just shows the skill of Chris Paul. I mean, in the post-game press conference, he's kind of laughing and saying, you know, if you give me a mid-range shot, that's kind of like a layup. And it's true. I mean, that's one of his skills. And I think in a previous version of the Rockets, he would have been discouraged from taking those. In this version, they realize that you have to play the counter and the matchup game when you get to the postseason. And Houston's done that very well so far in these playoffs. And that's really why their potential matchup with Golden State in the West Finals is going to be so fascinating, because both these teams can play big. They can both play small. They both can play completely interchangeable lineups. They both can shoot three-pointers in volume. They both have great one-on-one players in isolation. They're both going to be forcing teams to switch everything as much as possible, you know, in various scenarios. I mean, it's going to be like chess at a very, very high level in that series. And I think it's one of those things where a year or two ago when Houston played Golden State in the playoffs, you basically gave them no chance, you know. And yep. I think this year they're going to be a tougher out.
Very interesting. So I promised you I wasn't going to gloat on the Celtics too much. As it stands, we're recording this, they're up 3-0 against the 76ers. But I do have a question that relates to that series. So there's been a lot of talk, the NBA, on like lottery reform, maybe not always constantly rewarding teams that are tanking. And this season we saw a ton of teams tanking, more so than in years past. But I think the 76ers, on one hand, really do show the benefits of tanking and trying not to be stuck in the middle. So do you think they're kind of an outlier because there's plenty of other teams that continue to tank and not really improve? Or do you think the way they've operated maybe should give a case that we shouldn't change too much the way the draft lottery works right now?
Well, the first things first, Celtics fans should be gloating. I mean, this is the ultimate like house money situation with these injuries. And coming into the Sixers series, it was like the pressure was all on Philly because Boston's in this scenario where, you know, basically no one expects too much of them. And they have cashed in big time. I mean, it's like they're at the casino table. It's just running back, run it back, run it back, run it back over and over again, just, you know, winning thousands and thousands of dollars. And so now's the time to kind of fly that green flag. But in terms of the tanking issue, it's one of the, you know, biggest stains on Adam Silver's tenure, because but when he first came in, he was the guy who said competitive balance, parity. I mean, that's dating back to, you know, the lockout, basically, you know, almost 10 years ago now. That was his whole mantra, and it's really gone the other way. I mean, it's been super teams dominating the league, and it's been everybody else, you know, making these decisions of can we compete or can we not compete. I think the Sixers are definitely an anomaly, because not only did they tank harder than basically anyone has ever tanked in the NBA, they lucked out. They tanked at the right time. They found a Ben Simmons. They found a Joel Embiid, and they potentially found a Markelle Fultz. And so you put all that together. I mean, that is a very difficult thing for any franchise to repeat. And I think the tricky part here with his proposed lottery reforms is, you know, it changes the odds that you get that top pick a little bit. But it doesn't really dissuade teams from, you know, losing on purpose. And I think we're going to continue to see lots of teams lose on purpose, right? And are they trying to do that to mimic the Sixers, or are they just trying to do that in the hope that they can get one good piece to build around? It almost doesn't matter, because for their fans, the team is punting, you know, sometimes 30, 40, 50 games in a season, and that is no fun for anybody to watch. And so I'm not sure the problem is the Sixers necessarily. It's sort of the halfway Sixers copycats, you know, the teams that are, you know, get to the All-Star break and decide to punt at that point, because there's so many of them. All of them can't succeed. And we've seen a lot of franchises, whether it's Phoenix, Orlando, you know, potentially Chicago here, where they're going to be stuck in long ruts because, you know, their front offices didn't really pull the full process. And the other issue is, Adam Silver is basically stepping in now and saying, hey, you have to kind of play your healthy players down the stretch, you know, hey, you know, issuing warnings and memos to teams about the outright tanking. And again, that doesn't really solve the problem. It almost makes it worse, because what you're saying is, you know, you guys have to be a little bit respectable, but you're still bad. So those teams aren't going to be coming out of the lottery. You know, what's the difference if they win, say, you know, 28 games instead of 22 or whatever? It's still a bad product on the court, and there's still not much reason for fans to tune in. So I think when we zoom back and you look at the sheer quantity of teams that are stuck in these situations, you know, there's like 10 this year that were kind of taking that path. Yeah. All 10 obviously aren't going to be able to get the next Ben Simmons or the next Joel Embiid. You know, I think it's a real issue for the NBA. And I think their opportunity to really try to address it was when they just redid the collective bargaining agreement a year or two ago, but they missed it. You know, they failed. I mean, they didn't really put into place any new radical, you know, structural changes that are going to prevent this. And so I think we're stuck with the status quo here for the next, you know, 3 to 5 years, basically, no matter what.
So let's shift gears. I think everyone that listened so far has seen how prepared, how well you know your subject matter. I mean, you don't get to SI in your role without it. But so I wanted to ask you some questions on journalism, because I really like a lot of your style. So I'm going to ask you some questions based on some things that I've learned this year, doing more and more coverage of soccer, but it really applies as well to basketball. So I wanted to ask you, you cover a lot of teams, you mentioned a lot of teams in the NBA that tank. There are some teams that historically have been better run than others. I think, you know, for the most part, there aren't that many bad GMs, as say maybe 5 to 10 years ago, but there's still kind of a divide between some teams that really know what they're doing and some less than others. So I wanted to ask you, when you're covering and you grade every trade, you're really involved with transactions and whatnot, how much more leeway do you give to a team that has historically done things really well when you analyze their potential moves? So say, you know, the Kings make a head-scratching moves, okay, whatever, that's what they constantly do. But say a team like the Spurs, a team you have a strong affection for, when they do something that's a little bit puzzling, how much more of a leash do you give them?
Now, that's a fantastic question. I mean, it's one of the things that you have to constantly push back, because you can easily fall into that trap of, you know, we trust the Spurs no matter what, or, you know, you know, we trust the Heat. Like when they were making all those role player additions around LeBron, and it seemed like they couldn't mess one up, right? Like they bring in Birdman Anderson, they're bringing in Ray Allen. Like every single time, you just want to give them an A+ because their track record is so strong. Yep. I think rather than looking at basically what you want to do is look at each transaction individually, right? So like for the Pau Gasol example in San Antonio, which I know a lot of people were upset about, I think it's important to remember the context of their decision, which is, look, Kawhi's in his prime. They were very close to, you know, they were in the Western Conference Finals the previous year. They had every reason to believe they could get back. They were a little bit hamstrung in terms of how many players they could chase as outside targets. And so you have to understand really their decision-making. Put yourself in their shoes. And if the decision is, hey, we have to overpay Powell a little bit to keep him around and to keep this team together and try to make a run at Golden State, or we let him walk and we can't replace him, then that puts that decision into a little bit different context. So you have to really try to understand exactly what they're doing. And you also, you know, you want to avoid crushing teams sort of with the hindsight, right? Because there was no possible way for the Spurs to know that Kawhi was just going to go MIA. I mean, this is a guy who'd been a max level player, finals MVP, you know, all NBA guy, third in MVP voting. I mean, there's no way when they're handing out that money to Pau Gasol and Patty Mills last summer, they're thinking, oh, well, you know, Kawhi just might not show up. He might not even attend our games because he's going to be, you know, off in New York at the Players Association headquarters, you know, working out in secret, right? And so that wasn't really a reasonable thing they could have foreseen. A great example on this, though, where I made a mistake, it's actually your favorite team, the Celtics, which is why I'm going to own up to it here. Last summer, one thing that I looked at, you know, their overall body of work in the offseason that I was questioning was the sheer volume of new players that they were bringing in.
Yeah.
Usually when you have that level of turnover on a roster, it's a little bit of a red flag because, you know, okay, how are these guys going to gel? A lot of unproven names. A lot of the guys, you know, Danny Ainge is like plucking from overseas. You know, they're essentially no-namers. And it wasn't that I disliked any of those players individually. It was the accumulation of change after having a pretty strong season that sort of makes you, you know, a little bit uncomfortable. And I think what I needed to do when looking at that was remember that Brad Stevens has this track record of, you know, you throw him any five guys, even if they're lemons, he's making lemonade, you know, it's going to work out, you know, one way or another. And so that's really been the story, I think, of their entire season, but also this postseason run. I mean, the ability to, you know, get some of these, you know, unheralded role guys like a Semi Ojeleye or whoever and get some quality minutes out of those guys, you know, plug in an Aaron Baines and have him give you some pretty good defensive minutes against the Joel Embiid, even though he's getting posterized and people make fun of him. I mean, he's definitely having impact in the second round series. And, you know, Brad Stevens' ability to do that was something that I probably should have given more credence to rather than just assuming that, hey, all these new role guys are coming in. You know, this is going to be a, you know, a kind of a sideways type summer when in reality, you know, you could argue it was a pretty clear step forward last summer.
Yeah, I mean, and when you made that point, and I remember when you were first talking about it on the podcast, like I was thinking in the back of my mind the first year with Garnett and Pierce where they won the title, they had a lot of turnover too, but it was a lot more veterans. Now they're doing it too with like some young guys to having big roles. But yeah, Brad Stevens really can do no wrong. So let me ask you another thing that stood out to me, because this season, you know, we do a podcast twice a week and we cover the Italian league, like we preview the games, we talk about the games, and I really try not to be a prisoner of the moment, not overreacting to something that just happens. But I have to say it's quite a challenge when you're constantly covering a league, which you do as well on your podcast, Open Floor, which is really terrific. So tell me a little bit kind of how you juggle trying not to be a prisoner of the moment while also highlighting something positive going on in the league.
Absolutely. Well, I think there's value to both. And I think people who get too detached, that's a mistake too. You know, when LeBron hits a game winner and it's clearly one of those moments, you know, is going to be replayed ad nauseum for the next 10, 15, 20 years in terms of that, you know, one legged shot off the glass. Like the last thing you want to do is step back and be like, well, okay, but I've actually seen four or five, you know, better game winners from LeBron. So, you know, it's not really that incredible. I mean, I think your audience wants to hear everything about that shot. They want to really bathe in that moment. They want to, you know every little detail. So what did Dwayne Casey want to do defensively on that play? Who made the screw up? Why didn't they trap him? Why did he decide to go to the mid-range instead of pulling up for the three like he usually does? Why didn't he go to the basket? What did he tell Kevin Love about, you know, the shot, say, at shoot-around? I mean, all these different storylines come out of that single shot. And people really care about it. So if you're going to sit back and be detached and sort of, you know, anti-emotional in that moment, you're really screwing up. You're not doing your job.
Yeah.
So you do need to cover that stuff, you know, the right way. The historic moments, the big deal stuff, the turning points, let's say, you know, the end of game one, you know, Toronto, all those missed shots. That's a loss that's most likely going to stick with them for 2-3 years. I mean, can't you also see like a 30 for 30 about that, you know, about that game one, like the loss that ruined the Raptors franchise? I mean, there's a real scenario where like this core is just never the same after that game. Right. And again, if you're sitting back and just trying to play the math and say, well, you know, it's not really that big of a deal because how often are you going to miss 11 shots in the final 4 minutes consecutively? Like, you know, they're a better team than that. You're really, you know, missing out on not only what's fun about sports, but you're sort of missing out the importance that, you know, the emotional swings, momentum, and those kinds of things can have. But to your point, you don't want to be running around like a chicken with your head cut off at every turn of event, right? Like you do want to kind of try to have context. And so, you know, one thing that I use as a mantra just for myself, it's like, you never want to judge anybody on their best day or their worst day, right? And you don't want to assume that because a player, say like Dante Exum for Utah, has a great night defending James Harden, you don't want to assume that that's now the new norm, that for the rest of his career, he's going to be the best defensive on-ball guy in the league because he was able to lock down Harden once. I mean, that would be silly. Harden has a track record of 6 or 7 years as this elite number one offensive weapon, one of the best players in the league. And Dante Exum has a track record of 4 years of a lot of injuries, up and down play, trying to find himself and really struggling to stick in Utah's rotation. Right. And so that's a good case where, like, you know, some people were running around with their heads cut off because they'd been waiting. Maybe they'd been Exum fans. They were hoping for that moment. It was this huge breakthrough. And then what do you know? 2 games later, Exum's injured again, and, you know, he may be done for the series with the hamstring. You know, I haven't seen the latest update on that. So that's a case where, you know, using the context of what those players have done for years in the past can help you have a more realistic and more rational and balanced take on maybe how that game played out, where, you know, Harden was supposedly stopped by Exum. And mm-hmm. I think that kind of stuff usually accumulates over, you know, years of following your subject, and then also, you know, just hours and hours and hours of watching these guys and really honing in on their strengths, their weaknesses, and what's, you know, what's really a trend versus what's not.
So let me ask you a question a little bit on this topic as well. So your co-host, Andrew Sharp, I think does a fantastic job on Open Floor with you. Like, he doesn't hide the fact that he's a big Wizards fan. Like, the person, kind of my idol and the reason why I'm even doing a podcast and writing at all, Bill Simmons, openly a Celtic fan, and I think he's really made a career out of having the fan point of view and not hiding his fandom. You, on the other hand, I'd like to say you're really try to be as objective as possible. I'm sure you had a favorite team, favorite players growing up. I have a feeling now maybe you're more into teams that follow a certain concept and that do things a certain way. So I wanted to get your take, A, kind of when you lost your real fandom and how it impacted your work, and kind of what's your take on journalists who are openly fans of a specific team.
Yeah, I think, again, there's a pro and con to both. I mean, I think the most important thing is that you have to love the game. You know, I think if you love the game because you love a team, that's great. That means you're going to spend hours and hours educating yourself about your team, coming up with the strongest arguments and the most interesting points, coming up with the most interesting, trade proposals and everything else like that. If you don't love a team, the odds that you're going to be willing to invest all of that time and have that knowledge and that insight is a lot less, right? So I'm not one of these old school sticklers. I mean, I didn't go to journalism school. I was sort of a creative writing major in college, and I kind of came to sports writing in sort of a roundabout way. So it doesn't like grind my gears, when someone, refers to their team as we or us or anything like that. But I do think that it depends on what exactly your role is. Like, for example, I was covering the Blazers for about 6 or 7, maybe 8 years, where it was sort of like a halfway beat, where I was there at all the home games, every single home game, lots of the practices, you know, occasionally shoot arounds, you know, playoff training camps, you know, basically year round you're covering this team. It's very difficult to have that fan mentality and do that because you know the people personally, you just feel awkward. You know, you're not going to go up to a player after a game in a post game interview and be like, "Hey, Brad or Roy, why did we lose tonight?" You know, you're just going to feel stupid. You're going to feel out of place. And there's going to be sort of like a sort of a cultural type pressure to be like, "Hey man, like act like an adult here. You know, you're not a little kid. Don't wear a jersey in the locker room." And I think that separation is healthy. I think it's better for the reader in terms of that type of coverage. I think there's room for everybody in terms of, you know, fans and fan voices and sort of anti-fan voices, however you want to phrase that, within, you know, the broader, you know, sports conversation. But for me, having that be my entry point into the NBA, I pretty much never really felt like I was writing from the fans' perspective. It was more writing from, kind of a critics type perspective. I should also say that the first thing I ever wrote was called Draft Kevin Durant, which is a blog on just basically Blogspot. And in that situation, I was making the argument that the Blazers should take Durant, but I was coming at it from sort of the player perspective rather than the team perspective. And it wasn't that I necessarily wanted the Blazers to, you know, win a championship and, you know, that was going to be great. It was more like, look, Kevin Durant is the best player available in this draft, and here is why any team should want him. And Portland you happen to have the number one pick, you would be foolish not to take him. And I think there is a lot of people who nowadays who are coming at the sport from that player first perspective, right? They're not necessarily a fan of the laundry, you know, the team or the city. They're a fan of the players.
Absolutely.
And I think that that's healthy too. You know, as long as you can sort of be objective about what your favorite player's strengths and weaknesses are, I think that's been really big for the NBA. I mean, it's so much easier for a fan in Greece to be a fan of Giannis than it is to, you know, to find out where Milwaukee is and what the heck it's about and be a fan of the Bucks, right? I mean, Giannis is that entry point for so many different people, and we've seen that in lots of different ways. So I think it's constantly evolving. I think there's room for everybody. But I do think if you're trying to be sort of known as an analyst, or if you're trying to cover a beat, or you're trying to be a sort of a columnist where, you know, you're covering the entire league and you want people to take your, you know, analysis and your takes seriously, I find it's a little bit easier. There's just less pushback if you don't have that label of, you know, you're a fan of Team X or Player X, because you just sidestep those biased conversations.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, that story on the Durant blog that you wrote, we talked about it the first time you were on. So for people listening, this is really why I was so insistent on having Ben on the podcast, although it's not really about Italian football, because his story is really inspiring for anyone that's trying to make it in this field. So let me ask you, the final question that I have is on your podcast. So I mentioned Open Floor. I listen to it all the time. You guys record it twice a week. So tell me a little bit how important the engagement with your audience is, because your audience really sends amazing questions. I know you and Sharp spend a lot of time reading these long emails that your audience members send in. So tell me a little bit how that's evolved over time and how important that has been to the success of your podcast.
Well, I'll tell you this, we really backed into that one. I mean, we were doing the podcast for like basically a year, and we didn't really have any way for people to contact us except for tweets. And just for my own mental health, I don't read my Twitter mentions. So I think there was a lot, probably for a year, there was people just, you know, sending me stuff that I wasn't even, you know, looking at, just because I find it easier to kind of focus myself and, you know, put my takes out there if I'm not getting the constant blowback. So after about a year, I kind of turned to Andrew and I was like, hey man, do you think we should have like an email address where we can have, you know, people send in questions? And he was like, huh, yeah, that's a pretty good idea. So it's like, we had no plan to it. There was no like grandmaster social media strategy. We hadn't, you know, consulted with anyone. We hadn't heard from, you know, the higher ups. I mean, it was really one of those just like aha light bulb moments of like, what if we just open an email account and let people send stuff in? We couldn't believe how much stuff we got. And we realized that, you know, if we're doing mailbag segments regularly, I mean, we should have had that from the start. And pretty quickly, we felt really dumb. We were like, why did we not have this, you know, from day one? It would have made our lives easier. So we've tried to cultivate it that way. I mean, we did wind up calling our listeners the Open Floor Globe. Again, we sort of stumbled into that nickname. But if you look at some of, you know, the audio stars that I look up to, you know, a guy like Jim Rome has just been unbelievable on sports radio for, you know, 20 plus years. And I grew up on him. And, you know, how long has he been calling his listeners the Clones, you know, and how long have the Clones been embracing that name and contributing to his show? I mean, every year they have this huge smack off. I mean, it's like an entire universe unto themselves. And I'm not saying we're trying to like copy that or rip it off, but I think he was really onto something early with that idea. And I think, you know, constantly we're hearing from people saying, hey, you know, I'm part of the Open Floor Globe. I'm writing in from China. And you know, it just kind of gives this community feel. And certainly that's been pretty helpful for us. But I just recommend to anyone, like, if you're listening to a podcast and you really enjoy it, you know, contact the host. Let them know. Send in your ideas, because it is a two-way type of membrane. You know, so many of the ideas that, you know, we discuss are brought to us by, you know, listeners. And you know, some of the debates that we've had have been prompted by, you know, people, you know, trying to make an argument on behalf of their favorite team. I mean, even some of the people that we pick on, like the Raptors fans, you know, I jokingly call them the termites, you know, and because they just constantly come back for more and they never want to give up the arguments. And, you know, even stuff like that.
They're giving up now, though, right?
Well, and here's the thing. I got to give them credit because, hey, look, it's been another tough year for them, but they're still coming right back and they want to argue with me about, you know, I said trade Kyle Lowry and they want to come right back and say, no, we have to keep Lowry, and they're keeping the debate going. I mean, they really don't want to go away. And To me, that's sort of what it's all about, right? Because you're looking for the conversation. I mean, that's sort of what we want to be a part of in people's daily lives. And the only way we could do that is if we do interact with them. So, you know, the other things I do, I'll reply to like people, you know, people send me Instagram links, or they'll you know, tag me on stuff. I try to reply to those every once in a while. You know, we try to reply to emails, whether or not we read them, you know, in certain cases. And then what we've really done is tried to amplify, you know, female voices or international voices,
yeah.
Because in a lot of cases, those get under-discussed in the podcast universe, and young voices too. You know, if we hear from someone who says, hey, I'm 14 years old, I mean, to me, that's like the coolest feeling. You know, this kid's on his way to high school listening to us, and we like that too. So that's sort of our approach, but we don't really know what we're doing. Let's be honest. You know, we're out here talking sports, and if people want to chime in, then we want to hear it and give them a little platform too. And we always appreciate it, but I wouldn't say we're some like, you know, media monolith here. We're just kind of two guys talking basketball.
Well, you guys do a great job, as I'm sure everyone has heard on you today. Definitely check out Ben's podcast. It's fantastic. He has awesome articles on SI. So, Ben, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I know this is your busy time of year with the playoffs. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah, thanks so much for having me. We'll talk soon.